Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Guillermo Amaral joins me. We're going to be talking about software best practices for your open source projects. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Guillermo Amaral, episode 389, recorded May 24th, 2016, Best Practices Badge. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code FLOSS in the billing section to get your $10 credit. And by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stunage.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, the projects that offer lots of interesting services, projects that you might want to play with right after this show. Joining me this week is my lovely and talented co-host, Guillermo Amaral. Guillermo, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall, how's it going?
Well, as you can see, I've had a run-in, a bit of a run-in. If you're not watching the video, you should probably download this particular one. I'm half a raccoon right now because I lost a bet with a curb when I was at OSCON last week. Luckily, it was right after I filmed the last week's show, but it's not too bad. It doesn't hurt, just it needs to get away. But for those who aren't watching the video, yes, I have a black eye right now, about two-thirds of one. It's actually been healing already. But yeah, I'm in the kitchen set and at my place in Silicon Rainforest, and I hear there's going to be construction outside, which might actually mess up some of the sound, but we'll see. Hopefully, it'll stay quiet enough. And Guillermo, you're coming to us from, looks a little different.
No, that's my same bunker, only different angle.
Different angle, all right.
Yeah, my main PC right now is acting up, so I switched over to my laptop.
Okay, all right, cool. Well, this isn't a show about us. This is a show about interesting open source things, and this week is no exception to that. We have the Best Practices Badge Project, which we're going to bring on in a few minutes. We're going to bring on David Wheeler and Emily Ratliff. They're going to be talking about this project that's been going on for a little while. From what I could take away from it so far, it looks like it's a way to go through an actual checklist that's been curated by people who have done best practices for years, and you answer questions about your open source project. And if you get enough of the questions correct, the ones that are required and all that stuff, you get a little badge to put on your website so that the other people can see that you're following best practices, but they can also then learn that there are best practices to follow and go find out about them. So is that what you're taking away from this so far, Guillermo?
Yeah, same thing. I noticed that it does seem to be a little security focused, but I'm sure the our guests will be able to fill in that gap.
Okay, cool. And we'll bring them on in just a second. But before we do that, I have a very important announcement. If Safari will cooperate, here we go. Because whether you're developing an app, a website, or working on a server-based project, you need flexible, reliable, and affordable hosting. DigitalOcean offers Droplets, which are virtual private servers that can be customized and deployed easily to host websites, web apps, production applications, personal projects, virtual desktops, and almost anything else you can think of with full root access. This helps you to get your project off the ground quickly and making it easy to scale when you find success. DigitalOcean is used by over 600,000 developers, including me. At OSCON, I actually met a number of the people from DigitalOcean, and it was really cool meeting them since I've had a box there in the sky, in the cloud, for about a year and a half now since I found out about them at scale. You can deploy and configure your droplets via a streamlined control panel or simple API. You can choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. I'm a FreeBSD user, so I'm really glad that they have those out of the box. You can select from one of many pre-configured one-clicks, like Drupal, Docker, or Node.js, to get up and running quickly, or build the exact infrastructure you need, with root access to servers running 100% SSDs in state-of-the-art data centers around the world. And they're highly scalable to meet the demands of a rapidly growing application or business. You can also use the advanced features like floating IPs for high availability, private networking, and automated deployments via API. There's an extremely active community with a large and detailed set of tutorials on all the ways you can use your droplet. Want to configure a LAMP server? Set up a virtual desktop or VPN, they got you covered. And it's so easy to get started. You can deploy an SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing. Servers start at only $5 per month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it so you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code FLOSS for a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do. That's DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, enter the code FLOSS in the billing section to get your $10 credit for free. And we thank DigitalOcean for their ongoing support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, David Wheeler. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Welcome. Or afternoon, I should say.
Yeah, okay. And where are you speaking to us from?
From my bunker in Northern Virginia.
Northern Virginia. I think I've flown over that a few times. I don't think I've ever actually been in Northern Virginia, but maybe I have. I've been in a lot of places. And let's also bring on Emily Ratliff. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Austin, watching out for curbs.
Yes. Yep. Good plan. And especially on 6th Street there, those are really bumpy for some reason. I don't know what they do to break it, but it's really broken. Anyway, that's enough about this week in geography. So let's go ahead and get started. David, can you give us the 30,000-foot view? What is this project? What problem is this project solving?
Well, it probably helps to have a little history here. If you remember back in 2014, the Hartley vulnerability was found reported in the OpenSSL crypto library. And although the vulnerability was bad itself, I think it caused a lot of people to look a little more carefully because, wait a minute, there's a lot of open source software projects that we really depend on, but they aren't getting the kind of support and attention that they needed. So the Linux Foundation created a organization called the Core Infrastructure Initiative to try to resolve this. And frankly, probably Emily should speak up here a little bit on starting the Core Infrastructure Initiative, and then we can come back to the Badge Project, which is part of the Core Infrastructure Initiative. Emily?
Thanks, David. So as David said, in April of 2014, when Heartbleed was announced, immediately the media started looking at the OpenSSL Foundation and said, hey, wait, everybody depends on OpenSSL, but they're bringing in only $2,000 a year, and they don't have people really dedicated full-time the way that you would expect, given the impact of OpenSSL on the security of the internet. Yeah. And so Jim Zimmelin with the Linux Foundation called up 20 of the top technology companies who were members of the Linux Foundation and said, hey, this is a tragedy of the commons, and so we should all come together and develop this Core Infrastructure Initiative fund to ensure that critical infrastructure open source projects are receiving the support that people really expect them to have and which they deserve.
And so so because this is such an important piece of everybody's stuff, I mean, I know like the LibreSSL forked after that to try to alleviate some of those issues. So how does that transition then to have people helping support OpenSSL to something like the Badge Project?
So either one. What happened there was first, the Core Infrastructure Initiative, went out and talked to the top 10 projects that you would expect to see if they needed support, OpenSSH, OpenSSL, Network Time, GNU-PG. And then after that, the question was, in this broad universe of open source projects, who else needs support? And that's when they brought in David to work on the census to do kind of a quantitative analysis of open source projects to see if we could get some hints about which projects really needed support. And so then after the key players were kind of covered and taken care of, the question is turned then to how else can we support open source in general, and kind of, the rising tide raises all boats and lift everybody up. And that was kind of the genesis of the best practices project, with the thought being that if we codify best practices that the best open source projects are already using, and then people can make sure that they know what those best practices are and demonstrate that they actually are, you know, their project is running using those best practices, then that makes it easy to identify really healthy projects.
Yeah, and I've been looking over the criteria here, have a stable, just real simple stuff, like have a stable website that says what it does, how to get it, how to give feedback, how to contribute, and preferred styles, and you have to give the license type, whatever it is. I mean, these are things that I've seen over the years, but, you know, I've had 30 years of professional work now, or 35 years of professional work. But I know that a lot of the problem is that open source is rapidly expanding, and people don't necessarily get the folklore that I already have had access to. So is this meant to be informative, or is it meant to be more like testing, so that I would look for the best for the badge and not use projects that don't have that?
This is David. I think the short answer is all of the above. I think for many projects, they want to do the right thing, but they may not know that what exactly those right things are. I think you've hit the nail on the head because of that expansion in the world of free Libre open source software. There's a lot of people who don't know what to do. And frankly, there's some old timers who have not realized that some things have changed over the years. And what they did was fine at the time, but some things have become best practices and they're not aware of it. And of course, a lot of communities, you know, they work hard within the community, but don't necessarily talk to all the other communities out there. So our idea was to try to bring together all those good practices of various projects, the ones in particular that are widely, though not necessarily universally applied, and create that list of here's what to do first for the projects so that they'll know, hey, these are what are commonly accepted best practices. And frankly, for people who are looking at possibly using those projects, if a project doesn't follow a lot of those practices, that suggests that maybe that project's in trouble. I'll just hit real one interesting thing that we did more recently was we went back to OpenSSL, compared their current state with their state just before Heartbleed was announced. And we found out that the OpenSSL project, they didn't meet something like a third of the criteria that we had listed, whereas they meet all of them now because they've been focused on trying to, you know, wait a minute, we need to catch up, we need to do the right thing. And I think that's kind of telling. We didn't particularly rig it to do that, but I think that actually hints that we're onto something here. You know, these can't guarantee that the software is going to be free of vulnerabilities or perfect in any way, but at least they're announcing the world, here's what we're doing. They're trying to make it eliminate some of the key roadblocks towards supporting and improving their software. And by following best practices, they're way more likely to produce good stuff and be able to quickly fix things when there's a problem.
Yeah, some of these are actually remind me of things that I probably knew at one point, but it sort of slipped my mind. But like to enable collaborative review, the project source repository must include interim versions for review between releases. It must not only include final releases. And I remember some of the projects we've had here call themselves open source in sort of in name only, because they'll publish the source code for each release, but none of the actual working code. You can't give feedback. You can only you get a final release and that's it. So I'm glad this is all brought together. So how do I as a project interact with the badge project?
Oh, glad you asked. I guess we're going to reemphasize this URL probably, hopefully, a couple times here. But basically, go to the website bestpractices.coreinfrastructure.org. And our expectation is basically, you know, someone from the project would say, hey, let's create a badge and enter. We'll automatically fill in some things for you where we can figure it out. But basically, fill in a form. It takes about an hour. We do some automation where we can. We can't do some things automatically at all, but some things we can figure out. And once you fill in that form, in fact, as you fill in the form, you can see how well you're progressing. And when you're done, when you're done with the form, you either know, well, here's what I need to do still, or you know you've done them all, and then congratulations. And either way, you can put the badge on your website to either show, just like, say, a CI system, either that it's passing or it's not, and here's how close you are.
Okay, and how many are we talking 10 rules or 100 rules, or, you know, how many things are mandatory versus, say, just suggested?
I have to pull up the total number of criteria we have are 66. Now, not all those that you mentioned are mandatory. In particular, some things are, you can have, you know, not applicable. There's some things that only apply to particular cases and not others. If you give me just a moment, I'm going to actually pull up the numbers for some criteria statistics. So here we are. So we've got 66 of those criteria. 42 are musts, 10 are shoulds, and 14 are what we call suggested. The suggested ones, all you have to do is either admit whether you do or not. And we do it that way because we want to encourage people, even though we know there's a number of reasons why you might not do it. We want to encourage people to do those suggested things, or at least think about doing those things. But for the vast majority, they're actually, you must do those following things, unless they're totally not applicable. So 66 criteria takes about an hour, and really it's not hard to do.
So I go and answer these questions, and if I get a passing grade, what happens next?
Well, it's up to you, but what we strongly encourage people to do is then put their badge on their own project site. And a number of folks have done that in different ways. I know several folks, projects, for example, the OpenSSL folks, on their project page, they have just a straight up normal hypertext link to the badge entry, so that people who are can see that, yes, they're now, they've now implemented the badge. Here's where you can find out more. Lots of folks use GitHub today. And if you use GitHub, we provide some nice little markdown. You can slip right into your readme.md file, and immediately you can show off a badge. That's really common on GitHub. How much statement coverage you've got, whether or not your latest CI passed, and so this for folks who are using GitHub, this is a really easy thing to do. It's just yet another badge that they can add, but this one looks at a different picture than the other badges that are available on GitHub.
Was it difficult obtaining consensus on what's a must and what's a suggested?
Yes. Well, unsurprising, right? Actually, though, I think for the vast majority, there weren't many problems, interestingly enough. I'm saying yes because, of course, unsurprising, there are a couple that did get a lot of contention. But fundamentally, we're running this, how do you create criteria? So we decide, well, this is all about open source software. We're going to run this project as an open source software. So the criteria were developed as an open source project. Anybody can participate. The software that implements it is open source, BSD license. I'm sorry, MIT license. So basically, the first cut is that basically I ran through as much literature as I could manage to find out what people already generally agreed on. So we didn't really create these whole cloth. And I do want to give a shout out, by the way, right now to Carl Fogel. His producing open source software was really the genesis for a lot of the material. But really, we strive not to invent everything all ourselves. We're very much trying to capture what was generally accepted as already the best practices that just had never been put in one place before. Now, we had to change things up on the way they're written because we're trying to make that very, very clear. It's either a yes or a no answer. And so the text may be not look a little different than, say, Carl Fogel's materials, but the ideas are very much behind that. Since I'm mentioning Carl, I should also give a shout out. He actually was one of our reviewers, and he had some very, very nice words, a couple comments, but very, very nice words for it. I also want to give credit to Dan Kahn and Cohn and Sam Kakamoff, who also helped develop a lot of this.
Okay, and actually, before the show, Guillermo asked me in my ear here. It seems like you're emphasizing security quite a bit. Was that because of the origin of this project?
Yes, very much so. Now I have to be a little careful here because The things that aren't obviously security related, you can still argue have some bearing. I mean, if you don't know, if nobody understands what your project is supposed to do, you're way more likely to make a mistake security wise because you really don't know what you're going to accomplish. But absolutely, I mean, the Linux Foundation CII project was created in response to a particular vulnerability, Heartbleed, and realizing that we've got a general issue that we depend on a lot of open source software. That's great, but we need to make sure that it's secure and basically the lights are on at home. So yes, a focus on security, but frankly, I think that's the right thing to focus on now. If you focus on making sure that's not vulnerable, a number of other problems basically become less of a problem. And frankly, focusing on some just general good hygiene, good quality issues improves not just security, but in general, the reliability of the product, whether or not it does what you need and so on.
You mentioned that the during the OpenSSL Heartbleed kabakal, I guess, you guys already checked that the project right now is compliant, but could you maybe specify what could have changed between then and now? I'm really interested in knowing how having this, not just having this badge, but actually being compliant could actually help with what happened back then.
Sure. Well, let me first of all caveat here. You can get a badge and still have vulnerabilities in the software. We don't have any way to perfectly prevent all vulnerabilities. Even if you use formal methods, which is frankly the gold standard, it still requires that you agree that you implement according to a spec, which might itself have errors, and you know you might make assumptions that turn out not to be true. So instead of trying to achieve some sort of impossible perfection, what we're trying to look for is best practices, so that you're much less likely to have vulnerabilities, and if you do, the response is going to be much more effective, and hopefully, in general, the impact much less. So, if you can actually search on the project page for what we call OpenSSL before Heartbleed, which is actually one of our project entries. It's entry number 87 for those tracking on at home. So, basically. Probably the most obvious one is that they were very slow at patching vulnerabilities. They would know about vulnerabilities, but not necessarily respond to them in what most people would think was a timely way. They didn't have a general policy of when new functionality was added, they would have tests of it. There were tests, but it was easy to add new functionality. I think you're probably aware of the OpenSSL project historically. They loved to add new functionality, but they didn't necessarily add the testing to make sure that they were okay. They really weren't doing much in terms of enabling compiler warning flags or safe language modes and addressing those warnings. I think you guys are aware of just in many cases, the warnings don't necessarily indicate a problem, but sometimes they do. And it's very useful to find warnings of potential quality problems and fix them because they help you stay away from things that can become vulnerabilities. I'm sure there's some others, but at least that's a start. You can go see the badge application. It was actually filled in by one of the OpenSSL project members. In fact, that's something in general. We want the projects themselves to fill in the badge information because they're the ones that know how does the project work. We don't care so much exactly they do a lot of things as long as they do them. So if you use GitHub and GitHub tracker, the issue tracking, that's fine. If you use something else, that's fine. But we want you, for example, to be able to track your issues. We want you to do version control and that sort of thing. So we've very much tried to not isolate it to a particular tech or a particular server, but we definitely want people to do the right kinds of things.
All right. Okay. So I do kind of get the idea. Before OpenSSL was kind of slow to implement new patches, and if somebody found something, there weren't that many people working on it constantly, so it did take a little while to actually compare and see if it actually was causing an issue or if it, you know, one-off thing.
Right.
So yeah, I can see how this, especially adding things like CI and stuff, would actually help, strengthen the whole project as a whole. But we do have a question from the chat room, though. Easel wanted to ask if the best practices, well, not just the badge, but the whole criteria set, is that open source? Can people suggest new criteria? Or can somebody vote off one, for example?
Big YES. So yes, all the source code is MIT licensed. All the text is simultaneously MIT or CC BY 3.0 or later. So it's CC BY 3.0 plus. We've got our projects on GitHub. Please do send in comments, critiques, suggestions. We have a mailing list, so we'll take comments either from the mailing list or an issue tracker, or even the best from our point of view is a pull request. Love pull requests. There's some interesting thoughts here. And in fact, we've got an issue right now out for discussion about how we maintain the criteria. There's an easy school of thought, which I think would be a mistake, and that's that the criteria will be fixed forever, never changing. You know what? Best practices change over time. That isn't really sensible. On the other hand, it doesn't take a lot of time. It costs nothing to get these badges, but it does take some time. So we want to respect the people's time for changing criteria and such. We don't want to constantly change criteria on them. So our current thinking, and if you have any thoughts, please pick up on the issue. We're currently thinking about making updates once a year, say, in the calendar year. And before we do that, we actually already set up a system where we can create what are called future criteria. These are criteria you don't get graded on, but you can fill them in. And the idea is that we would add those future criteria, month or 2 months before we transitioned anything. And then and that would give projects time to answer those and if they have issues with that, to make any adjustments. And then at a future time, change the criteria, and hopefully projects will have already, for the most part, implemented those updated set of best practices. So we're trying to respect both, people's time, but not just try to stay fixed forever, because that doesn't really make any sense. And we would love feedback. Open source project, as long as you're willing to comply with those licenses, it would be fantastic to have even more participation.
This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it will be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment system is easily acceptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily, too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment system comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no such stressing about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. There are simple and secure payments code that you can integrate quickly. The Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. There are SDKs in 7 languages: .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. And it's elegant code with clear documentation. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. You can learn more at braintreepayments.com/floss. And we thank Braintree for their support of Floss Weekly. And I had a question, and after reading the ad, I forgot what it was. Guillermo, can you bail me out here for a second?
Yeah, no problem.
Sorry.
You did mention that you want to future-proof this a little, right? So if you have, let's say, future criteria to, maybe work on. So, if it changes later on, you'll still be compliant, I guess. Is there anything already set up for somebody who already is compliant at this moment in time, but maybe they let their time go by and never really check back if anything changed? Is there like a task force with guns and everything that, will go and stop them from using the badge at some point?
Oh, goodness. No guns. There's 12 projects that have badges. I probably should have listed earlier some of the projects that already have badges. That includes Node.js. So Rod Vag, I think is how he pronounces his name, worked on that. Greg KH worked out for the Linux kernel. GitLab, OpenSSL, Curl, Zephyr, OpenBlocks, SyncThing. There's actually a common mark from the PHP League, and there's actually some kernel Linux kernel backports, and they've already have the badge completely. That's not to say that other projects wouldn't earn the badge. It's just they've already gone through the process, filled out the information, and have confirmed, and they can show off their badge. And we're gotten right now, frankly, we're hoping to see even more. There's a lot more in progress. You know, for example, I know that OWASP SAP is really close. There's a number of other folks that are very, very close to completing their badge. So I'd love to see more, either closer, even better, to actually complete the whole thing.
Okay, and I remember the question. It's the problem is I switched Safari tabs, and when I went to a different tab to read the ad, I came back, and the stuff I wanted to do wasn't highlighted. So I'm actually looking at the criterion down here, and one of the things that really caught my eye, since we are talking a lot about security here, is it says, as one of the requirements, the project must have at least one primary developer who knows how to design secure software. First off, shouldn't every developer know how to design secure software?
Well, you're speaking to somebody who actually, in my copious free time, I actually teach graduate class on how to develop secure software. So I am a big, and I give away a book on how to write secure software. I am a big fan. Everybody should know how to develop secure software if you're developing. But you know what? This is kind of that basic level. It's hard to demand it all at once. Right now what we're saying is if you've got at least one, that one can teach the others. So you're right. I mean, it would be better if everybody knew. Areas right now, if you start with one, you can teach the others. But if nobody knows how to do the work, then there's no way to get better. And I think that's actually probably an emphasis for a lot of the, these criteria is there. Many of them are not so much you are at nirvana, but it's basically setting you up so that you can improve, so that you can get better. Once you have a developer who knows how to design secure software, and once they know what the common mistakes are, they can help the others learn. But if you have no one, then you're kind of out of luck. Same for a lot of these other ones. Turning on the warning flags does not immediately make all magically better, but now you're starting to become aware of some of the problems and can start addressing them. And that's really what we're trying to help projects work towards. It's not, I am done, but I am ready to continuously get better.
Yeah, and I'm a street-trained programmer. I never went to any formal schooling, and sometimes it shows up in my code, but I have actually run across most of these terms. Like you say, the eight principles from Salzer and Schroeder, I imagine that's the book you're talking about. Economy of mechanism, fail-safe defaults, open design, separation of privilege, least privilege, least common mechanism, psychological acceptability. Ooh, you have to be – oh, human interface. Okay, good. Limited attack surface. Maybe I'm not acceptable psychologically, though. I don't know. Anyway, and input and input validation with whitelist. So, just looking – if all this badging project does is get these words in front of more open source projects, I think we're going to have the internet be the wild, wild internet. It will be a much safer place to live. And I'm sure that's one of your goals, right? Not just have people badges.
It absolutely is. What? And I appreciate you listening, but I do want to quickly note that if you go to the badging thing, we not just list those words, we briefly explain what those mean. So that
I didn't want to take five more minutes, though.
I appreciate that. Yeah. But we tried to make sure that if you're not familiar with those words, we define, we actually explain them. It's not a lot of words, but a few words so that people will know what they mean and can then apply them. And I agree with you. I think the world of software has changed a little bit in the sense that at least some people are a little more aware of the amount of attack that software is undergoing now. The problem is a lot of developers really aren't prepared. They're still thinking, well, you know what, I'll handle the common case. And who would ever send in that that. I mean, realizing that if it's a way to break the system, the answer is every attacker is going to love you for it. So our expectations really should have changed decades ago, but they need to change now. We need to expect that our software is going to be attacked. It's going to be attacked by people who know what they're doing for under attacks. So we've got to design our software so it can actually resist those attacks.
And Emily, you're trying to break in there?
Yeah. One of the early reviewers of the best practices project was a security researcher. And his comment was, when he finds vulnerabilities in small open source projects, when he reaches out to the projects to let them know, oftentimes they don't have an easy way of being contacted. And then when they are contacted, in many cases, it's the first time that they've ever considered the topic of security. And so he was very hopeful that if more projects adopt these best practices, then it will force them to think through things like vulnerability handling processes, ensuring that they have an easy way of being notified of the vulnerabilities, and that when they receive that first vulnerability, it's not the first time that they've thought about security, and so it doesn't cause an immediate panic, but they have a plan in place for how to deal with it.
If I can jump in on that for a moment.
Yep.
We not only create, we crafted these criteria from existing materials. We, as an open source software project, released those out. We actually contacted several projects basically as alpha testers. And we got some helpful feedback that caused changes to the criteria, and I appreciate that. But a number of the changes actually weren't in our criteria. We actually had a whole lot of changes in projects instead, even before the criteria were finalized. One of them is one that Emily's just alluded to. A number of projects didn't have any identified way to report a vulnerability. And what's funny about that is that this is trivial to me. Add a sentence to your README or your project homepage, and you're done. But for a lot of folks, for a lot of projects, there was no obvious way to figure out how to contact anyone to report a vulnerability. And from the security researcher's point of view, this was actually one of those ridiculous barriers that could be easily solved. So that's one of the criteria is you've got to tell us how to report vulnerabilities. There's a million ways to do it. Just say what it is. And that enables that communication so that, I'm sorry, it's hard to be perfect writing software. Got that. But at least make it easy to report when there's a vulnerability.
I also have a question from the chat room. Emily the Strange says, I'm trying to sign up on the best practices site, but I can't. Interesting. Well, so maybe chat afterwards.
chat afterwards, file bug report. That shouldn't happen. We'll go fix it. But in fact, you can go to GitHub and file an issue track, or worse comes to worse, for issues like that. Or any other issue. Just go to our GitHub page, file an issue. Shouldn't happen. But you know what? Unfortunately, the app that we use the badging, it's probably got a bug in it somewhere, and we are happy to get bug reports and fix them.
Cool. And I also misread one of your criteria here, so I'll just want to let you know it from the writer part of my brain. It says the project security mechanisms must use default key links that meet the NIST minimum requirements. And the way I read that was default key links from what NIST tells you. But you don't mean that. You mean at least those minimums. So it was a little weird.
That's right. At least that.
Yeah. I was going to say, no, you must stick with the smallest size.
Better is okay. Better. But you can complain about really anything that we list. But where possible, we tried to point out to other folks who work on things like, what are the minimum key lengths? Well, I mean, we could make stuff up. But we'd rather point to somebody else who's worked hard at trying to identify, in this particular case, key lengths. Because you know what? DES is totally unacceptable now. It's 56 bits of effective key. And for modern software, that is trivial to break. Modern systems is trivial to break. And we still find people using algorithms or protocols that are broken or just... In the case of DES, it's not technically broken, but the key length is just too short to be useful. And so we actually have a number of questions about that, specifically because that's a common mistake even now. And even now, it's a common mistake to use these really old, useless, basically useless algorithms.
I also, I'm sure you understand the irony of suggesting a version control system like Git, and then down about in the security criteria, just, and you probably shouldn't use SHA-1.
Well, we've had a lot of conversations about that. Stay tuned.
Okay.
But that is a common problem. In fact, a number of people have commented about that. We could probably have another whole show about that. But we can at least say, goodness gracious, Des, you don't need that anymore. Get rid of it. Git actually has an interesting problem. And part of the issue, I would say, is that there's a misunderstanding. A lot of the Git developers, SHA-1 to them is a way to test for data validity, and they don't think of it as a security mechanism, even though everybody else is using it as a security mechanism. And I think there's a misunderstanding. That's my personal opinion. I suspect we'll hear more about this in the years ahead.
Now, I have a little question, though. For example, I guess a lot of my peers have a few little open source projects out there that might not really get that much attention, I suppose, game engine. And so my question would be, would implementing this on, let's say, some of my projects, would that be a burden on to me? Since it's really only me and maybe two other people who work on these projects, or is it just focused for somebody like, let's say, Firefox or, you know, larger projects out there?
We really designed this to work for everybody. And that actually is a little remarkable that you can actually do that. But frankly, and Randall noted at the beginning of the show, a lot of these are kind of, well, goodness, I mean, you know, that you do describe it. You don't have to have a 1,000-person project to write a brief description and tell us what is the purpose of this project. Version control. Once you've done it, it's frankly time saver, even if you're the only developer on the project. So none of these things require big projects. And I think it's actually interesting to note. I haven't mentioned this before. The badge, we have criteria. We also have an application that's a web app that lets you fill in the form. And guess what? Our software gets our own badge. it's a small, the badging project itself is a relatively small project. And, you know, it's not got 1,000 developers on it. We're basically using and building on the criteria that have been identified by others. And yet we managed to get our own badge without any problem. The curl project is a relatively small project, got a badge. On the other hand, the Linux kernel, huge project, also has a badge. Now, I will say that we did this intentionally. When we were developing the criteria, we intentionally reached out to a couple projects ranging from small to big. And we got some interesting feedback specifically to adjust the criteria to handling small projects versus handling big projects. So the Linux kernel folks, for example, had some comments about the way we had originally worded criteria. And it wasn't that they disagree with the concept. It's just they believe that we need to reword a little bit to handle large scale. Conversely, when we interacted with small projects, they said, yeah, we can do that functionality, but make sure you don't require it this particular way because, again, we can do the way, say, the Linux kernel development project does, where they've got a huge number of resources available to them. So it took some effort, but I think we actually managed to come up with a criteria set that works for everybody, both small and big.
Cool. Hey, we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you both one more important question. Not that the rest of these were unimportant. I now apologize for that. But we'll start with Emily. Emily, is there anything that we didn't cover today that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
Really, I just want to reemphasize for everybody that is working on an open source project, go out to bestpractices.coreinfrastructure.org and try to get a badge. And if you get a badge, awesome. If you don't get a badge, let us know what the problem was. via GitHub issues or via the mailing list. You can find the mailing list on lists.coreinfrastructure.org. And let us hear from you.
Cool. And before I ask the same question of David, one of the things I like about it as I was reading through it was that you allow for what we call freemium or core projects where you have, you know, some of it is open source and you want to make sure these practices apply to that. But there might be like private branches that people can't push as public data, or maybe that's part of their premium models or whatever. So I like that you've addressed that in the way the licenses are written up and everything.
Thanks. We tried to be inclusive. So, you know, if you're, you know, no matter your license, no matter your business, or if you can have a business model, we want to be inclusive that way.
Cool. And same question I asked Emily. Is there anything that we left out?
You know, I'm just going to reemphasize what Emily said, because really that's the thing is we've worked hard to develop the criteria. They're reasonably good. We think they're great, actually. And the issue now is we want projects to actually take advantage of them. So please, bestpractices.coreinfrastructure.org. If you are involved in a project, please add your project to it. It's a way to show your users that you care. It's a way to see how well you're doing. My guess is a lot of projects will find they're actually doing pretty well. A few may find, well, I'm doing mostly well, but I forgot about this. And my experience with a lot of projects is they see the one thing they missed, and it's not that they disagree with it. It's that just nobody had thought to ask that question. And so I think for a lot of projects, they either get the badge immediately or see a few things to do, and hopefully they're responsible. Yeah, that's a great thing. Thanks very much for telling me about that. So please come get a badge.
Great, great. And so I want to thank you, David and Emily, for coming on the show today and talking about this very important new piece of infrastructure that we're throwing out there.
Thanks. Are you not going to ask us about our editors and scripting languages?
Oh, you must have seen previous shows.
I'm a faithful listener.
Oh, thank you. Okay, real quickly then, language and editor.
All right. Scripting language, I vacillate between Bash, Python, and Ruby. And okay. Editor, obviously the one true editor, which is Vim.
Nah, good man.
See, what was the point of me asking that? Okay.
For me, just because I have a history of Perl scripts built up, Perl and VI.
Well, yeah. One out of two ain't bad. One out of two ain't bad. And I know why I had to ask that. One out of four answers total made me grin a little bit. So thanks guys. Thanks, guys. That was David and Emily coming to talk to us about the Best Practices Badge Project. What do you think there, Gamo?
Well, I'm always happy to have people on who like BI editor. You know, that wasn't the topic, was it?
No. I meant about this whole project.
I'm really happy that there's you know, organizations like this trying to help people, you know, especially people who might not know what the best practices might be. And to get that sorted out and you know, just make sure they're at least, you know, complying with a small set of the required ones for an open source project. So it's good.
Yeah, and I also really like this sort of meta-ness of this project is that it's an open source project to help people build their open source projects better and not requiring them to, you know, get a four-year degree like I never got to or you know, buy a bunch of expensive books or something. It's all in one place, and you can help share the knowledge about it, which is even better. That's really cool. So without further ado, since we are running close to the end of time here, at the end of time. Oh, no, it's not a 32-bit rollover for Unix yet for the epic. Okay, so like I said, at OSCON last week, one of the big advantages of being at OSCON and being a press person as a media badge is that I got all the press releases coming in like crazy from people who wanted to promote something at the show. Of course, they always want to schedule me to be, you know, with their guy in the booth at the show. But I always say, nope, don't have time for that. My damage card is already full. So instead, I just send them back into the big spreadsheet and say, fill yourself in. Well, we've got a lot of new people because of that, which is really, really cool. Next week, I'm pretty excited. We got Varnish Cache on. Varnish is a reverse web proxy so that it speeds up your website significantly. So by doing stuff like compressing JavaScript, compressing compressing CSS, and then also assembling things. So you have only one web hit instead of multiple, things like that. So used by almost all of the really, really big websites. So especially my last three clients. So, well, hopefully there will be more clients. My most recent three clients. There we go. This one's going to be my last. Okay. Then GitLab. We haven't had GitLab on before. And again, this is one of those projects that really helps open source, you know, actually happen. And of course, we mentioned GitLab a few times this time. And so one of the senior guys is going to talk about the open source part of GitLab, because not everything is open source there, but enough of it is that you can use it on your own. So away from the infrastructure they provide for you. Otherwise, why would you want to? It's so cheap. GitLab is so cheap. DataStax, which is Cassandra NoSQL stuff. So we're going to get back into document storage and scalability and stuff. That'll be really cool. Just added to the schedule. Biturgia, actually bumped into them at the conference. As well as them sending me a press release a week before that. They're about software development analytics. You can see what velocity your project is actually moving at by seeing the rate of commits and the rate of bugs being burned down, things like that. So they're all about the analytics for that stuff. Lisk, which is a JavaScript-based sidechain blockchain application in the cloud. That sounds pretty cool. We've had a lot of stuff about Bitcoin and other blockchain stuff on here. And so Lisk is taking a new approach with that. Just added to the schedule again, Koha ILS. It's a library information system. So we had Evergreen on, I think maybe 4 years ago, but this is similar to that in that people can set up open source top to bottom and manage their libraries, do the interlibrary lending, all that sort of wonderful stuff. They claim they're the first open source one. So I'm going to have to talk to them about the Evergreen people and see who actually gets to file that claim. Unless maybe Evergreen's gone. And then also just added to the schedule, LucidWorks, which is about searching your data. It's about searching your images, searching your all sorts of wonderful things like that. So, yeah, real cool. We are always adding more shows, always adding more slots for shows, and always trying to get more people to fill those in. You can find out about all that by going to the homepage for this show, which is twitch.tv/floss. And from there, you'll find a link to the big spreadsheet where I maintain and manage everything that's coming up. I am opening up Q3 about a month at a time to try to keep the shows compressed together. We do have a live stream. We took a couple questions from there today. That's at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays, typically. We occasionally move it around, but mostly it's that. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus. You can follow that gets tweeted over to @FlossWeekly. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus. That's where I originate most of my content. But that also retweets over to Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. In a couple weeks, I'll be at the Pro Conference, renamed from Yapsi. It's now actually just called the Pro Conference. O'Reilly gave up the name, which is great. Then I'm going to be where is that at? That's going to be Orlando. Yes, I'll be in Orlando, staying inside the hotel the entire time. Won't have to go outside for that. Okay, and then I'll also be at the Red Hat Summit, which is coming up a week or two after that, which is in San Francisco. So all of my San Francisco friends watch my tweets and hang out with me. Texas Linux Fest, right back in that really dangerous Austin place. I am not going anywhere near 6th Street, especially not with a cane. That's the only way I'm going to survive. If you see me in about 5 weeks, with one on the other side, you'll know what happened. It's really a mess. But Texas Linux Fest, it's only a couple of days. It's towards the weekend. That's going to be fun. I announced a few times that I'm going to be in Porto Alegre, Brazil. But again, the Zika virus and the whole thing is scaring me. Not that I'd personally get it, but like that I would be a carrier and then not know about it. And I travel way too much, so I don't want to be that guy who's infected half the world. That would be really bad. And Labor Day weekend, Dragon Con, I'm on 4 or 5 programs on the EFF track. And I'm hoping for a couple of slots on the podcasting track, so I can talk about Floss Weekly and the art of the interview and all the stuff that none of which came out today, but okay. Yeah, I did okay, I think, most of the time. And that's all the plugs I have. Guillermo?
Well, I guess people can follow me on Twitter, which my handle is @GAMARAL. I also have a YouTube channel, so you can just Google me, or I guess just look for my Twitter and you'll see a link there. I'll be on BitCon next month. So if somebody else is going over there on I think it's in Anaheim or close to LA anyway, you can look for me there and have a beer. I think that's it.
Cool. All right. Guillermo, thanks for jumping in at the last second and being my co-host for today, as you often have rescued me before. I appreciate that.
No problem.
Thanks a lot. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.